Well, great to be with you. Great to be with you this particular summer through the summer series. I hope if you are here for the first time, it's a helpful time. I think it's a really important time, and it's great to be together to consider these topics. They really are very significant. Who we are as humans has got to be some of the deepest issues to consider. And each of the series that we look at, the kind of sessions over the next 3 weeks, we'll hit some very big questions, some big topics. Today's one is fundamental and huge. Are we an accident, humans, or are we designed? Are humans designed? Are we as humans merely the product of random events and chances over a long period of time that just happened to throw up us, humans, which could have otherwise thrown up something else? Or are we designed by a designer? Are we created? Now, that is a massive question. Why is it so big? Because the implications are extraordinary. The implications actually roll into our whole life, our whole existence, our whole being, into every aspect of who we are. You know, the implication, the kind of size of this is not big because of the answer you're going to get. You know, it's not an amazing thing to work out what I'm going to say in answer to this question. I've been asked a few times through the week, people with this smirk on their face, so have you worked out what the answer is yet? You know, what are you going to say? You know, is it accident? Is it design? What do you expect a church to talk about? You've come here, it wouldn't be a surprise, surely, what the answer is I'm going to present. You know, like the fact is the Bible is quite clear on this. Let me give you a bit of a taste of it. In the very beginning, the very first chapter of the Bible, chapter 1, God says this. It's reported for us that he says, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness." So God creates mankind. They're not an accident. God creates humanity in his own image, male and female. He creates them in his image. Chapter 2, second chapter of the Bible. "Then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the earth and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being." Again, no accident. The Bible is emphatic from the very beginning. It's not just either the first creation of humanity that is God's design. The Bible makes it very clear that each of us is knitted together. Psalm 139, the Bible says that you created us in our inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. God's personal creation of each of us. Into the New Testament, you come into Acts chapter 17 and you get these words, that God himself gives all men life, breath, and everything. From one man he made all nations. The designer God creates. The Bible's emphatic. It's very straightforward. But more than this, it says the world that we live in is his creation. His creation to be inhabited by us. So Isaiah, the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, chapter 45, verse 12, says, "He didn't form it to be empty, but to be inhabited." The world we live in, it's rich variety, its beauty, its intricacy is designed by God to be inhabited by us. Designed. Now, that's not a surprise that a church would teach that. What's surprising, and perhaps surprising for many of us, is that as we went around and talked to friends, family, workmates, neighbours and so on, hundreds of people we surveyed about whether they thought designed or accident, not just a dozen and not just people who come to church, but people outside of church, 70% of people said they believed also that the world is designed. Is that extraordinary? Now, for many of us, that's quite a surprise. That's not how we perceive the world around us, and the secular media is saying something otherwise and so on. I think it's such a surprise. We had a funny little mix-up with slides through the week. So we got a great bunch of guys and girls who do fantastic work on design, but somehow or other the pie chart had the 70% section of it saying believed accident, when actually the statistics said design. And we think it's because they thought it must have been wrong, the sheet they got, and so they changed it to actually make more sense. But no, it's 70% said that we are designed. And it's interesting to ask why people feel that way. I don't know if you've got friends and family who are not church people who think similarly. Ask them why they think like that. And the answer typically rolls around these kind of issues. It just looks and feels designed. There is the intricacy of the world, of life. The whole process of child rearing, birth, conception, all of that is just so amazing. Miraculous even. that a child can be formed in the womb from a few cells and so on and come in birth and then learn language, words and so on. There's something there that just is the beauty of life, the shape of my inner life. All of this speaks to so many of our community about there must be a design, a designer. Which therefore leaves you wondering, what are we going to do today? We're all agreed. Question time. What do we do? It seems pretty straightforward. Well, actually, no, it's not quite so straightforward. There is something far bigger going on in all of this, and it's this. It's the interplay between the question of whether we're designed or an accident and the implications. You know, at present, for most people, as I say, the vast majority of people think we're designed. But for most people, the vast majority of people who think that, it's just irrelevant that we are. You know, I don't know if you ever have those kind of late night conversations where, you know, you're at a party and it's kind of really wearing down and you start that kind of intimate discussion about life and existence and so on, or you're around the table outside and it's summer night and you're having these conversations and, you know, you have these discussions that don't really have much impact on your existence. They're just interesting and, you know, one of them might be is there life on other planets. And so you have this conversation, maybe, maybe not. But as you have the conversation, you're aware that it doesn't really matter. It's not going to change my weekend. What I plan to do in a month's time when I'm travelling is not going to be any different. Okay, so there's some cellular life somewhere else. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. I'm going to chase that girl. I'm going to chase that guy. And that's life, work, and so on. It doesn't have any impact on my circumstances. And for many, this issue is in that same category. Designed or accident, it's interesting to talk about it, but we've worked out how to live life, whatever. I can still function and get on and do what I want to do and whether there is a design or not. And so we do park it into that category. I want to say to you today, this issue, when rightly understood, has huge implications for weekends. It has a huge implication for what you do on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, all your life. It transforms and changes everything, if you understand it rightly. And the implications are so significant that when you begin to see what they are, it throws you back into wondering what the evidences therefore are for whether we're designed or an accident. You know, when there are no real implications, perceived implications, then I don't really care what the evidences are, we can just talk about it. But when I see what the implications are, I go, wow, how do I really know therefore? Because it really matters, I better find out properly. And so today, here's my plan. I want to talk about the implications firstly. I want you to see, my hope is today, to help you see the weight of these implications, the significance of these implications, that you might then be driven to actually go, wow, how do I really know? Then therefore, whether we are designed or not, because it matters so much. And then we'll come back to the implications. So three steps, the implications, evidences, and then back to implications. Let me start with the implications. Come on this journey with me. There's three implications. This will be the largest part of what we do together this morning. Let me give you the first implication that follows from God having designed the world. If there is a God who has designed the world, the first implication that necessarily follows is that humans are inherently valuable. Humans are inherently valuable and uniquely valuable. Now let me illustrate. The surfboard. Now this surfboard is a 1960s Steve List design that has been expertly crafted and put together in such a way that it looks quite remarkable, doesn't it? All done by me. And that's really all I want you to show this morning. So, well, that's basically the point. Impressive, isn't it? It's been signed by Rabbit Bartholomew and Sean Thompson. If you know anything about the surfing world, they're world champions, the first, second, and third world champions in the world, who wanted me to produce boards for them. No, they didn't, but there you are. Now, why have I got that up there? Well, here's the deal. I designed and I made that. I put it together. And it therefore has, by virtue of my investment in my design and care and concern for it, it has value. It's inherently valuable. I made it for a purpose. I'll talk to you about that in a moment. But it's precious. So that the first time I took it for a surf, I had it in the back of the car, and I've got a four-wheel drive that you kind of can sit through the back seats and so on. And you can see it's polished up. It's got a gloss coat and it's all smooth and so on. And I get down to the beach and open up the back door with the board sitting there, and I go around to get my wetsuit. And as I came back, the board has, because it's so shiny, slid out of the car onto the asphalt and smashed on the ground. Now, people have often asked me over the years whether I ever cry. Well, I didn't at that occasion, but there, I could have. It's and so it damaged the thing. Now, it's precious, you see, and I felt the pain of its hurt. Now, this is something that's very different to this. This is a box of a vase that had an accident. I was a little bit involved in that accident. And this vase fell onto the concrete from a fairly high distance, and the accident has left it smashed up and so on. Now, the question to ask, this is an accident. This has emerged from an accident. It just happened. It's smashed and so on. Valuable? No. What do you do with stuff like that? Well, I'll try and glue it back together and Kathy will love it. No, it's rubbish. It's just, it's got no value inherently. Now, here's the trick though. You could take a piece of it that's sharp and go, well, I could use it as a knife, a cutting implement. So I could create a value out of it. I could use part of it for something valuable. But not because it's inherently valuable, but not because it has value in and of itself. It's just because I can find some use for it that might then give it a value. This is just valuable in and of itself. It's an extraordinary piece of thing, which is the nature of created stuff. Being created gives it value given by its creator. So its value exists from outside of itself, given to it. It's the nature of creation. Let me apply that to humans. If it is true that the Bible is right when it says that humans are created by a designer God and created in his image, as unique in all of creation, then the implication of that, the necessary implication that follows, is that humans are inherently valuable. We are, whether we perform any function that's valuable or not, we are valuable. Come with me to a part of the Bible. If you haven't got your Bible, that's okay, listen in. But Genesis chapter 9, in that very early part of the Bible we had a reading from, Genesis chapter 9 speaks to this, and just listen in if you haven't got a Bible there. Listen in to this verse, verse 6. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made mankind. Now let me explain that verse. It's fairly straightforward, but whoever sheds human blood, whoever kills the human, shall have their blood shed. They'll be called to account. There will be a retribution in light of the crime they've committed, murder. Why? Well, the text tells you why. Because in the image of God has God made mankind. Because God has made humans, designed humans in his image, they are precious by virtue of being a human. And so to take human life is itself a crime, punishable for it, because humans are valuable, inherently valuable. Don't kill them. It's worth noting that as people more and more have embraced the idea that we're just accidents, that evolution over time has thrown up this thing called the human being, as more and more people kind of embrace that thinking, though still there's the design, is very strongly embraced through our community. But whilst more and more people embrace that notion that we're just an accident, human value is diminishing. It's not hard to work this through. If it is the case that a human is a bunch of molecules and atoms just arranged in a certain shape, And it's just simply the case that over a long period of millions, billions of years, those molecules formed into a human, but the same molecules formed into a tree stump. The same kind of molecules formed into a cockroach, into a piece of rock. There's nothing inherently valuable about this arrangement of molecules versus that arrangement of molecules. It's just time and chance has produced them in this shape. Time and chance could have produced, or did produce this shape. And so it's an accident that we're formed this way, which therefore means our arrangement of molecules is no more inherently valuable than any other arrangement of molecules. And the consequence of that is, if I have an axe, there's nothing different, really, ultimately, about putting the axe in the stump or in the human. They're just a different arrangement of molecules. No one's more inherently valuable. Do you get the implications that follow from being an accident? Do you know, this is following through into many contexts. My eldest son teaches English at a local school, and he had a year 10 class, I think it was, and he was throwing some kind of larger life thoughts to them, which I think is fantastic for our education system to have happening. But he raised with them the question of a burning building. And he said, imagine a burning building, and within the building there's a family who have been living there, and they've rushed out and left their baby. You've never met that family. Baby's left in the burning building. But your dog, your puppy, has rushed into that building as well, unbeknownst to you, and they're both trapped in the building. Which would you rush in to save if you had the chance to save one of them? Now, I hope you're astonished by this, but a great number of the students said they would only rush in to get the dog. And so he entered into a long discussion about whether humans are more valuable, even though you don't know them, than a dog that you do know. And I don't think he got far. Because what's to make one more valuable than the other? Well, what makes one more valuable in a world like this is that I know and love this arrangement of molecules, but not that one. There's nothing inherent in the other. Do you remember that incident with the gorilla in the enclosure where a child maliciously, mischievously climbed into the enclosure and was in danger of being killed by the gorilla? And so they shot the gorilla to protect the child. And there was a great outrage on social media. Does anyone remember this incident? Because what had the gorilla done wrong? It was the child who'd been mischievous. The child, therefore, lost the right to life, whereas we should have privileged the innocent animal over the human. Do you see what's happening? The necessary consequence of a world that believes we are just random accidents, molecules forming in different ways, is human value disappears. There is no inherent. Now, this is not some weird, strange thing happening. It is actually emerging from academia. So our elite thinkers in the world of ethics and philosophy are promoting this kind of understanding. So Peter Singer, some of you may know of Peter Singer, who's a very popular writer, an influential voice worldwide. He says this: we can no longer base our ethics on the idea that human beings are a special form of creation made in the image of God, singled out from all other animals and alone possessing an immortal soul. His point is that given that we now don't believe in a designer who has made us as valuable in his image, we can no longer run our ethics according to that. We now need to think of a whole other basis, which for him is called utilitarianism. It's your value is based upon your contribution, what we can find that's useful in you. And if we can't find anything useful in you, you've not got value. So therefore that means infirmed people, mentally disabled people, unborn people have no contribution to society and so therefore are less valuable to us. The implications of this question are massive for how you think about yourself. Let me give you the second implication. It's the issue of purpose. It's the issue of purpose. Design implies purpose. If you design and make something, it's implied that you have a purpose for the design. Accidents, by their very nature, are purposeless. Let me unpack this a little bit for you. When I designed this and made this, I had a purpose for it. What do you think the purpose was? You'd be wrong. You've got to ask the designer what the purpose is. I'll tell you, we had a wall in our house that was a big wall that had nothing on it, and we wanted to put a bit of art on it, and we thought we needed something long to put on it, and I thought, well, a surfboard would look awesome, but I couldn't afford to go and buy one of these things. You know how much one of these things costs, a balsa board? So I thought, oh, I can do that, so I made it to put it on the wall. It was designed as an art piece. So I've only ridden it once and can't bear to take it back out in the water again. But you see, I designed it with a purpose, you see. That's the nature of design. This just fell onto the concrete and smashed. It was an accident. The very nature of accidents are that they are pointless. That's why we call it an accident. You smash your car, and someone says, why'd you do that? And you go, it was an... We had these arguments at home all the time. It was an accident. I didn't do it. It was an accident. It just happened. It didn't have a point to it, Andrew. There was no purpose in it. I just had an accident. There's no reason. Now, like the first implication, value, we might choose to give an accident some value, find something in it that you can use it for, reclaim its value in a sense, but it has no inherent value. In the same way with accidents, we can give it a purpose. Do you know? So you can, in an accident, in a thing that is accidental, you can find some purpose for it. You know, well, I like to think it happened because of this. I like to think it happened because of this. I like to think the purpose. But what you're doing there is making up a purpose. There actually isn't a purpose for it. You've given it one. You've made up one. And that's okay. You can do that. But just know that when you're doing it, you're creating an arbitrary thing. Whereas when you're designed, there is a purpose. There's something outside of us that says you have a purpose. It's not subjective, made up by us. It's given to us, imposed upon us. It is the way we are. With this, you could use it for whatever you like, and no one could say to you, that's wrong. You ought not do that with it. Who's to say what I ought to do with it? There's no purpose to it. But with a design, if I find after I'm gone that my children use this for an outdoor workbench just to smash things on, I will haunt them for the rest of their days. I'm looking at you. Which I know they wouldn't do. But you see, if they use it for a thing other than its purpose and its value, it's wrong of them to do that. You see, humans, we are designed by a designer, and inherent in that observation is the fact that humans have a purpose. We're not just free to do whatever we want. We actually are made for a reason. What is that reason? Come with me to Acts chapter 17. And again, if you haven't got your Bible, that's okay. We'd love to get you one. It's an extraordinary thing to begin to read these words, but Acts chapter 17, look there at verse 26. I read this verse a little earlier, but I want to add another piece to it that comes from this same passage. Verse 26, from one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. God creates, he's the designer. He himself, verse 25, gives everyone life, breath, and everything else. There's the creation again. So we come back down to verse 26. And he marked out and appointed the times in history and the boundaries of their lands. So God's design over us is that he creates us, brings us to be from the mother's womb, but he also places us in where we are and so on. He sets the boundaries. Verse 27 tells you why. God did this so that we might seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any of us. God did this for a reason. He made each of you. He knit you together. He placed you in this place, actually, for a reason. He's the designer who has a purpose for you. And the purpose that he has for you is that you might reach out to God and find him, the designer, the God who made you. That's why you exist. In a place, Colossians chapter 1, verse 16, it says, he made us through him and for him, the Lord Jesus. There is a reason you are here. There's a reason you were made in the image of God, designed by God, fashioned by God, with all the preciousness of being in his image. He made you like that, that you would be of the kind of person, the kind of being, who can actually have relationship with the God of the universe. He made you for that. He wants you for that purpose. The implications of design: value and purpose. Let me give you the third implication. This is the largest and the deepest, and for most, actually the breaking point. The third implication of design is this: we are not our own. We owe someone something. We owe the designer. We are owned by the designer, like the pot is owned by the potter who fashions it. We don't have an independent life. We didn't make ourselves. We were given life by someone else. We were given breath every day by someone else, and everything else by someone else. And the implications of this are that we owe the one who has given us all these things. Come with me to Revelation 4, the passage that was read that's in your outline. So if you've got your EV News there, you'll see this. Dave did read it to us at the outset. Revelation chapter 4. You can find this kind of idea all through the Bible, but I've just picked out this verse because it's the last book of the Bible. It just seemed nice to bookend the whole thing. Have a look at chapter 4, verse 11. And I'll just go through this text with you. You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory, honour and power, for you made all things. You created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being. Two halves to the verse. The first half is that God is worthy. He is worthy of glory, honour, power. Why? Second half. Because he created all things. He's the creator. He didn't fashion us from pre-existing stuff. He made our world from nothing. Everything that is because he made it to be so. And then he fashioned us from all of that, breathed into us the breath of life, gave us life and existence, and continues to uphold us by every breath that he breathes into us. He is therefore, verse 11, worthy. Worthy of glory, honour and power. Because he created all things. And it's by his will that you exist. Wow. Do you get the implications? Who are we? As humans, who are we? Are we accidents? Or are we designed? The implications are massive. If we're an accident, then life is yours to do with as you please. Eat, drink, be merry, for tomorrow you die, you'll rot into the ground. You've got no purpose, there's no value, no meaning to your life. Do whatever you want with it, make the most of it. If you want to believe there is a purpose, if you want to create a purpose that satisfies you, go ahead. Choose a purpose. Doesn't matter which one you choose, actually, because there's no right or wrong in this. There's no ultimate purpose, so you can make it whatever you want to be. And if your purpose, you want to make it helping others, go for it. If that's what you find satisfying for the few short years you exist and then cease to exist, go for it. But if the purpose you think is something you'll find most satisfying is to use and abuse and get as much as you can and be as powerful as you can, go for that. Just don't do it near me. But go for it. There's nothing wrong about that. We don't like it. Most of it won't like it. But if you can get away with it, we'll all die soon. It won't matter. There's no purpose. And if you want to believe that humans have some value, go for it. But if we're an accident, we don't have any value. You can make it up that we do, but and if you don't want to believe we have value, you can do that as well. There's nothing right or wrong in this. There is no right and wrong. We're just a cosmic accident. But if we're designed, if it's true that we are created by a God who made us in his image valuable for the purpose of knowing him and enjoying him and having life with him forever, if he made us for that purpose, then the aim of life is to live that purpose, because that's what you're made for. And it means, of course, if that's what we are, we actually owe our Creator. We owe him. Now, I think most of us get this intuitively. It's the reason, actually, Jesus can tell a parable in Mark chapter 12 like this. In Mark chapter 12, and if you want to follow, turn up there. But in Mark chapter 12, Jesus speaks to the crowd of people that he's with there, and he gives a parable about a vineyard, a man who plants a vineyard, a place with wine, vines and so on, and builds a wine press. So they've got all the tools they need to create the wine. They've got a guard tower to keep it safe. They've got fences to hedge it all in. A fantastic place. And notice that the owner actually builds a vineyard because he wants them to enjoy. You see, it's this fantastic gift. He puts a bunch of tenants in there. And Jesus says in verse 2 there, at harvest time, he sends a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. After all, he gave them the vine, he gave them the wine press, he gave them the guard tower, he gave everything for them. Give the owner a bit of wine. But what they do, verse 3, is seize the servant, beat him, send him away empty-handed. Well, the owner sends another servant. They strike this man on the head, treat him shamefully. He sends still another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. They beat them and killed them as well. He had one left to send, a son, whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, "They will respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him, killed him, threw him out of the vineyard. How do you react? Jesus turns to the crowd after telling this little parable. Whether it happened or not, it's not the point, but he is playing on our intuition here, and he turns to the crowd and he says, what should the owner of the vineyard do to people like that? What do you think the owner of a vineyard should do if people treated him like that, after giving them everything? And after simply calling on them to honour him as the owner, what should he do? Well, they answer with one voice, he should come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to someone else. He should exercise justice. And Jesus makes the point, verse 10, that he is the Son come from the owner to his people to call them, to honour the giver, to be full of gratitude and thanks to the giver. What will they do to the Son who has come? They will end up killing him. Jesus is anticipating the reaction of the crowd. You know, all of this sets the stage for the most important question of our human existence. And that's not overstating. This sets the stage for the most important question of human existence. What will you do with your life? Will we live ignoring the one who made us, who gave us life, breath, everything? Will we, with every servant that he sends to call us to himself, ignore him and dismiss? Will we treat the Son who comes with disdain? What will we do with our lives with this God? Or will we bow the knee and honour him as we ought? You see, this material, it raises the most fundamental questions, because it sets the context for the most fundamental reality of our human existence. Everything we have is a gift given to us by a loving God. The powerful implications of design. Three of them. We are inherently valuable. We have a purpose. And we owe the giver, the creator. But something profound happens as you reflect on these implications, I think. And I've had many years of talking with this about this with people, and something profound happens. As the weight of the implications begins to settle in, and your intuition kicks in and says, wow, yes, if there is a God who's done all of that for me and I owe him everything, then I ought to live for him. I don't want to live for him. So what do? Well, I'm actually not so sure anymore whether we are designed. Because I see where that's going. And so this second part of my time with us together is to think about the evidences. Very briefly, actually, much, much more brief than the first part. My point now is to push back to the start and say, why do we think we are designed? What might we say to someone who isn't sure whether we are designed? This is not a full account. It's a quick taste to give some direction to thought. And I'm going to give you six reasons why we can be sure that we're designed, plus one. And I'm separating out the seventh one that will become obvious in a moment, I trust, because we're going to go through this fairly quickly. Let me give you the six reasons why you can be sure we are designed and not an accident. Here we go. The first one is the intricacy and shape and beauty of existence. There is something about our lives, the human organism, the interplay of so many biological, physical functions in our existence, the wider world. Just pick up a leaf and there's just a beauty and an intricacy about it, and the way it works with the seed, all of the life of the tree, the sunset, the baby who is born and its growth. There is this intricacy and beauty and design that inhabits the world, such that David Attenborough, even when he's talking about the kind of power of evolution, he keeps talking about evolution as if it's got a purpose. You just can't get past the sense that there is this in the intricacy and shape and beauty of the world around. And the deeper world of physics and maths. One of the astonishing things, Paul Davies is a British astrophysicist. He's actually the founder of the Australian Centre of Astrobiology. He says, a common reaction amongst physicists to the remarkable discoveries of this beauty is a mixture of delight at the subtlety and elegance of nature. Is that not a persuasive evidence for the existence of intelligent design behind the physical universe? Yes, it is. I'll give you the second one. The fact that the universe even exists. This is compelling. The universe has had a beginning. Science is now sure of this, and you may disagree with the age of all of that, but 14 billion years ago, they're saying. Before that, we're told there was nothing. I agree with that. But think with me about this. How did something come from nothing? Well, we're told by the scientist, well, the creation and the laws of science meant it had to emerge. Well, think into that. Hang on. So you're saying the something that eventually exists created the context for it having to exist. So I call that as foolish as saying, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. It's just absurd. No. If there's nothing, then there's nothing to create something. Something doesn't come from nothing. What brought the universe to exist in the first place? What was their first cause? This has compelled many people to look further. Go three. The fact of life. So we now have, let's call it a physical universe with matter and material and so on. But you think with me further to that, where did life come from in that universe? You've got matter, inanimate rocks, dead stuff. How do we go from non-cellular to cellular? How do we go from not living to suddenly there's something alive? How do you put lots of dead stuff together and get something alive from it? Francis Crick, who was a British microbiologist, and he was one of the men noted for being a co-discoverer of the structure of the DNA molecule, a very capable scientist, said, "The origin of life seems almost to be a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to have had been satisfied to get it going." Just so. Let me give you the fourth. The fine-tuning reality of our existence. There are a number of constants in physics and chemistry and biology that have to be exact for life to be possible, for the universe to be possible. The mass of the electron, the speed of light, the strength of the gravitational force, these things all have, there's numbers of others where you've got various constants that actually have to be perfectly aligned for it all to have occurred. Any slight change in them and life would never form, the universe wouldn't form. Stephen Hawking, who's an atheist cosmologist, admits, the remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. Yes, they were. There's also the Goldilocks principle for the world that we inhabit, that it's not too far, not too close, it's not too hot, not too cold, it's just right. Its orbit's just right, it's the size of the sun is just right, the size of the planet's just right, the angle of the axis is just right, the oceans are just, the oxygen level, it's all just so right. Let me come back to us though, number five, the human mind. Whatever the mind is, and it is a mystery, it is in some sense non-material. Our thought life may emerge in some fashion in relation to physical processes, but our thought life is itself non-material. Wow. How did material stuff give rise to non-material thought life? That's compelled many, and a man called Thomas Nagel, who is a famous New York philosopher, university lecturer there, has written on this at some level, caused great outrage because he himself is agnostic. He began actually an atheist, he's moving, but he said there are obviously now two things that exist in the universe, material stuff and mind. Where did that come from? Let me give you six. The fact that we know there is inherent value, meaning and purpose to our lives. For all the kind of claims of the elite academics that we're just an accident and there's no real purpose, no real meaning, no real value, we just can't live like that. There's just a reality that we exist where humans are different. It's not because we're bigger or smarter. We need meaning in our lives. There's something about us that cries out, there must be more. And the Bible's answer is, it's because God has put eternity in our hearts. He has made us in his image, designed us. These things irresistibly point many people to this direction. Now you put those six together and there's this kind of compounding thing that each one on their own is not conclusive, but together there's this massive weight that says, the heavens declare the glory of God. Day after day they pour forth speech, if you would but listen. But let me give you number seven, because number seven is the clincher. Number seven is the deepest, biggest, most amazing piece of it all. Number seven is the historical event of Jesus. That the designer of the universe, the creator of the universe, entered into our world. The author of the book wrote himself in that we could see him. And the author came amongst us 2,000 years ago and lived with us. And he did it publicly in history so that there could be a record of his time with us. And he lived the most extraordinary life, as you expect God in the flesh to live. He did the most extraordinary things. He spoke with a wisdom that was unparalleled. He healed the sick. He raised the dead. He calmed storms. He did and said things that no man has ever done before or since. And he claimed, in the midst of all of that, to be God come amongst us to seek and save the lost, to reveal, to bring us into the light, that we might see the author of life and know him face to face. Because God wants us to know him and has put his money where his mouth is. He then dies and rises again from the grave, to show conclusively, with public evidences around it, that there's a life beyond, there is much more, that we were designed for much more, and it's possible now because of this God's love for us, having given his son for us, to actually come back forgiven for having lived as if we were an accident, ignoring the giver, not honouring him as he ought. He comes to actually make it possible for us to be forgiven and come so much as he wants us to actually know him. Friends, this is a massively important issue that concerns our very existence. It has massive implications, implications that confront us, challenge us, and actually change the way you think about every day of your life. Let's pause now, though, and have some questions.
You've got a lot of questions coming in, good, all good ones. This one's good. Where did God come from? Did he create himself like the Big Bang created itself?
One way or another, you've got to have something eternal. Now, we're dealing with mysteries here. But the ancients used to believe matter was eternal. But because something can't come from nothing, there has to be something that gives rise to something. Well, that something has to be eternal. It's either material stuff that's always been here, or it's spiritual. Yeah, they're your only options. They're your only options. So either the universe has always existed, matter's always existed, the laws of science have always existed, and if that's the case, where did they come from? Or a purposeful first cause power, non-material, eternal, has always existed. You've got to go with one or the other. And the Bible, because of number seven, if we could put that back up actually, just to keep that there, with the Bible with number seven, the historical event of Jesus, compels me to see that there is a God who is himself eternal, who was never created. Because if he was, then there's something before him that created him. So he's the eternal one. There is an eternal someone there who has given rise to our universe. And the evidence for me is Jesus that compels me to see that truth. But you've got that exact issue to wrestle with. Something's eternal. Which is it?
Now, this question's a big one. It's come in a bunch of different times, phrased in different ways. It's around, if God created us, why are people created with illnesses? And also another little twist on it, why would he create someone like Hitler?
Yeah. It's good to do questions, yeah? One of the deep insights of the Bible is that... So what's that? Mobile number? We were on. One of the deep insights of the Bible is that when God made the world, he did make it very, very good. So Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2, you get this refrained by God, and it was good, and it was good, and it was very, very good. In the first, it was perfect, or as God intended, with everything the way it should be. But there was an event that occurs in our ancient history. The Bible reveals to us that humans, in our determination to not honour God, to not give thanks to him, but ourselves want to replace God, to be ourselves our own gods, broke the world, changed everything, and brought devastation into our whole experience, so that human nature changed, but also the physical realities of existence changed and were fallen and devastated. So the consequence of that first decision shattered not just humans and the way that Hitler behaves and selfish people behave, but shattered even the physical environment within which I live, such that, that there are anomalies and broken things and the way things emerge. And Jesus, when he comes from God, sent by God the Father, when Jesus comes into the world, he comes with this extraordinary power to actually make right the broken things, to make right the sick, to make right the storm, to make right the accident that's occurred. He comes displaying this power and giving a taste of God's desire to bring us back out of the world of brokenness we've created into a perfect world again forever. So where did it come from? We brought it into the world. Yeah, it's astonishing.
And we got time for two more. So this is an interesting one off the back of that answer then. Who wrote Genesis, the creation account in the Bible there, and how can we validate that? So I think that's coming from the position of, well, no one was there to write it. How did someone write it?
Yeah. In life itself, we're always dealing with things that we don't personally experience that we rely on authorities to tell us about. How many of you have been to the sun? No one's been there. But we rely on people who have made observations and experiments. They've not been there either, but they've determined and discerned things and they've told us how it is. A great deal of life, we have to rely on those authorities to give us the evidences and information for things. If you're dealing with a spiritual realm, if you're dealing with a realm that is larger and bigger and more beyond us, that goes back before us, you are utterly at the mercy of an authority to reveal the way things are. Do you know, it's a man called John Lennox, who's a Oxford mathematician and philosopher, he said this. He said, science can get a cake and it can investigate every kind of chemical composition and shape of the cake, and it can describe it all and it can go through the mechanics of how the cake works and so on. But what they can't do is tell you why it exists. But he then said, Aunt Mabel, who baked it, can. And the one who baked it, you can trust. There is exactly our context. You know, scientists have some access to mechanics and shape and matter. They can't talk to you about non-material things. That's the nature of science. It can't do it. But if Aunt Mabel comes amongst us and demonstrates how trustworthy they are and how good they are and helps us understand things beyond us, we can trust it. And that's exactly the claim of the Bible. Which, if you're here today wondering about whether you can trust the Bible, whether Genesis can be trusted and so on, I would urge you to go back to one of the Gospels and start there. That's where I started. I didn't grow up in a home that went to church, and I had to investigate these things for myself. And from an engineering background, I was kind of skeptical and what have you. But I stepped into the Gospels and I looked at them and I thought, is this historical record of the person of Jesus reliable? And is the person I meet there reliable? Did his death and then resurrection occur as evidence of his reliability? I went through all of that. And the history of it is compelling. It's overwhelming. Come along to life and we'll go through a great deal of that. And having then affirmed the reliability of this witness, Aunt Mabel, who's come, I listened to them about why we're here. And it fits so much of my existence here.
I'll finish this one. And again, many people have asked something like this. If it's so clear that we are designed and not an accident, then why is there no scientific proof? Why wouldn't God use science to steer us towards himself?
Oh, can we chuck those things back up again? The seven things? Look, many of those first six are science things. But get this. Science has overreached in the last 40, 50 years. Science has begun claiming for itself that it is the only source of true knowledge about anything. Do you believe that? I call that, well, it's been called scientism, actually. It's scientists claiming for themselves far more than they can claim. There are many things that are true that science does not help us know. My wife is infatuated with me. I think she's here somewhere, that's why I use that one. My wife loves me. I could have just said she loves me. But my wife loves me. Now, can science prove that? Science doesn't operate in the world of personal relationships. It can't. Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon and kicked off a whole new transition in the Roman Empire. Can science help me know that happened? Science does not operate in the realm of history. It can't help you know what happened historically. Do you see? There's a different realms of knowledge that science just does have no access into. It can give confirmation things here and there, but it can't tell you why, can't tell you other important things. There's lots of things there that confirm the realities of design, but they can't actually tell you ultimately why the cake was made. But here's the wonderful thing. you don't need a science degree to listen to Aunt Mabel. Do you know what I mean? You just need the Creator to come in amongst us and tell you and give you sufficient evidences of his reliability and the power and circumstance of who he is, which is what the Gospels record for us, for me to go, I don't need all the science because I've got a way of understanding who God is that's fundamentally reliable, though not scientific. Science is not the answer for lots of things in life. Come to terms with that. Appreciate, though, rather, that the Bible brings us a record of a person's visit to our planet that is life-changing. And my aim here, let me finish, is to confirm that our instincts that we are designed have lots to back it up, and ultimately the historical event of Jesus establishes it firmly. But in the midst of that, I want to help you see the necessary implications of us being designed, that we're valuable, that we're purposeful, that we owe, therefore, our Creator. Because over that, I want us to come face to face with the God who loves us, who sent his Son to call us back, who actually gave his Son's life that we might be forgiven, who actually made us for himself. And your hearts will be restless until you find rest in him, because you were made for him. Let me stop there.